A sense of calm for markets across Asia on Monday. Stocks seemed to steady in early trade after days of chaotic trading. Hong Kong's Hang Seng was up 0.7%, following its worst week since the 2008 financial crisis. And China and South Korea both gained about 0.9%. Japan's Nikkei is closed for a public holiday.
Latin America takes its coffee seriously. Case in point, in Costa Rica, farmers there plant only the high-end and more flavorful Arabica bean. And since 1988, it's been illegal to plant the cheaper, more bitter variety, Robusta. But now a growing number of farmers in quality coffee-growing nations like Nicaragua and Guatemala are dedicating more land to the bean's cheaper cousin, Robusta. Still, in countries like Colombia and Costa Rica, some have feared shifting to the lowbrow bean will spoil their reputation as suppliers of the world's best coffee.
As the world watched a dazzling show unfold in Pyeongchang on Friday, it's been revealed that behind the scenes, Olympic organizers were busy battling a cyber attack. On Sunday, officials confirmed the games had been attacked during the opening ceremony, but say it didn't compromise any critical part of their operations. A spokesperson says all issues were resolved Saturday morning and that they know the cause of the problem. Russia has already denied involvement. Days before the opening ceremony, it said any allegations linking Russian hackers to the Olympics were unfounded.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's February 12th, 2018. 5:20 in the morning. Glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business week getting underway. Another business day. We've got a good show for you this morning. The business of architecture is front and center this morning. The CEO spotlight this morning focuses on Thomas Kerwin. He is the principal at BKL Architecture in Chicago. We're going to be talking buildings and architecture. And a little bit later on in the program, a new report on the number of smartphone users who have financial apps. You'll be surprised by the number, maybe. That's coming up in our second segment this morning. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, futures are up triple digits this morning, nearly 300 points on the Dow, nearly 75 points on the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ, S&P, and Dow futures all up more than a percent heading to the opening bell later on this morning. Overseas, markets in Europe are all in the green this morning, with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC, again, all up almost a percent. The DAX is up almost 2% this morning. And in Asia, markets are generally mixed, with the Hang Seng lower now. The Shanghai is higher almost by a percent. And all of the other markets in the green. The Nikkei closed today, as you heard there in the opening montage, for a public holiday. Some stories that we're watching for you this morning. President Trump today will unveil his long-awaited infrastructure plan. But people are saying, where's the beef? The administration's plan is centered on using just $200 billion in federal money to leverage local and state tax dollars to fix America's infrastructure. The president has repeatedly blamed the crumbling state of the nation's roads and highways for preventing the American economy from reaching its full potential. This plan would now allow states to use some of that federal money, but also to bring some of their money to the table. The question is, how far will this go, considering that many states are in financial turmoil and have very little extra money to spend? The Senate begins a rare open-ended debate on immigration and the fate of the Dreamer immigrants today, and Republican senators say they'll introduce President Trump's plan. Though his proposal has no chance of passage, Trump may be the most influential voice in the conversation. Ultimate support will be vital if Congress is to overcome this election year issue on the Dreamers and immigration. And also today, the president is making big promises to reduce prescription drug costs, but his administration gravitating to a relatively modest step, such as letting Medicare patients share in manufacturer rebates. Those ideas would represent tangible change, and they have a realistic chance of being enacted, but it's not like calling for Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Skeptics say the overall approach is underwhelming, and the president risks being seen as an ally of the powerful pharmaceutical industry. It is Monday, and that means it's our CEO spotlight this morning. We're happy to have Thomas Kerwin here this morning. Thomas is the principal at BKL Architecture in Chicago. We're going to be talking about the business of architecture. Tom, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited for our interview today because I love looking at architecture, but I don't know a lot about being in the business. And so I have a lot of questions for you this morning. But first, tell us about your company.
My company is named BKL Architecture. I'm the founding principal. We formed the company 2010, so we just celebrated 8 years. We're a firm that does a variety of scale of projects and heavily invested in Chicago, doing a lot of exciting things here, but also all over the world. And we're a firm that's very passionate about doing good things and contributing positively to anywhere that we build.
Your website, which is often the front door to your business, is beautiful, I have to say.
Well, thank you.
Some of the projects that you've done, the people that work for you, stunning display. So when we see the cranes everywhere in Chicago, are you happy when you see that, when you drive around and see that in Chicago?
I'm very happy, especially since some of those cranes are building our buildings. So yeah. There's nothing more exciting than seeing the realization of, you know, our work and a project being built. So, in fact, if I'm having a bad day or if I'm having something's going wrong, I go to the construction site because there's nothing puts a bigger smile on my face than being at a construction site.
We should tell people that the planning for some of those cranes, behind those cranes, begins months, maybe even years in advance. Tell us about the timeline of something like that.
Yeah, it certainly depends on the scale of the project, but most of the projects we do are sizable and are pretty complicated. And definitely years before a crane goes up, we're starting. And typically, there's a pretty extensive process at the front end for getting what we call entitlements, and that is the permission to build on a particular site. Most of our projects, our clients are looking to, you know, build more or build taller than what traditional zoning would allow. So going through that process, that community process, the process with the city, and then coming up with a design to go through that process, but then actually producing the documents from which a contractor can build takes many years for many projects.
The projects that you seek out or are involved in, do you find ones that are specific to your mission?
Well, we believe in notions of building in the core of cities, sustainability, keeping this migration back to cities is happening all over the world, and we certainly see it in Chicago. So I think at our core, we'd like to build in urban areas centered around public transit. That's core to our belief, and we also believe and enjoy working on projects of different scales, different sizes, and also different types of uses. And oftentimes, what's happening that tie those two things together is that when people are building in the core of cities, you know, land is at a premium. And in order to diversify uses and mitigate economic risk, they'll typically put multiple uses on one site. Retail, sometimes hotel, coupled with apartments, and now you're seeing more and more office developments that are also part of mixed-use developments coupled with hotels or perhaps even residential.
Give our listeners a sense of an example of one of your places that you've done in Chicago or some ideas of... Put a name behind the building.
Right. We did the first building at Wolf Point, which is the site that sits a very key strategic site in the history of Chicago, where the three branches of the Chicago River come together, right south of the Merchandise Mart and the Apparel Mart for the Kennedy family and for Heinz Interest and Magellan Development. We built the first 500-unit residential building on that site. We're working on a project that we're very excited about just out the window here called Rennell, which is just west of the Wrigley Building and tucked behind Trump Tower. It's a small boutique condo building. It's 18 floors, but it's 50 units that is facing the river. We did the GEMS school. We're doing actually two high-rise, what we consider high-rise schools, a 10-story K through 4 elementary school that sits at Lakeshore East, just tucked behind Wacker Drive, south of the river. And we're building the second phase of GEMS, which is the grades 5 through 12 that's on Wacker Drive. So we're also working on office projects. one of the most exciting things we're doing now. We're doing so many exciting things, but we're also working on three new buildings along the lake, where the lake and the river come together, which is the last parcel at Lakeshore East yet to be developed, affectionately known as parcels IJKL right now. Originally master planned as four towers, and we've remaster planned it to be three towers, and we're in the process of going through the approvals with the city for that project.
You know, one of the hot areas, too, is the Fulton Market. You're involved over there as well, aren't you?
We are. We're working on two projects over there. We have one project under construction, and then we have another project soon to start construction called Union West, which is at between Washington and Madison, and between Morgan and Sangamon. Our client from Miami secured the rights to build on this piece of land, and then 3 weeks later, McDonald's announced their headquarters was being built a block away. So they're happy campers is the official term, I guess. But
yeah, when did you know you wanted to be an architect, and what went into that?
Yeah, I knew fairly young. I get asked that question a lot. I knew fairly young, and I'm not totally sure why, but I did get enamored with. I always was enamored with making things and you know, realizing things that came about working with your hands. And I got really enamored with the drawing tools as a kid. And it seems odd to think about this, but I got enamored with, you know, going to those old-time drafting shops. And this is when we were still drawing by hand. And you would, you know, pick up these tools of, you know, compasses and scales, and I just got and the different types of pencils. I mean, I can still remember going into these stores when I was a kid, and just also looking at how expensive this stuff was, and I didn't have a lot of money, so I was always saving money to buy these tools. And then I just always appreciated the fact that, and realized early on that I can go walk through and walk around something that I spend a lot of time on, and that to me is still gets me jazzed every day. So
Listeners probably would, I'm one of them. In high school, we had a semester called drafting is right. What we called it back then. It was exciting to draw stuff, but it's changed a lot. Now it's all computers, isn't it now?
It is all computers. I mean, we still sketch. We still build models by hand. I mean, there's even with 3D printing and things, we still build paper models and we still sketch by hand, but yeah, the tools we have just, you know, they're unbelievable what we can do now. And, you know, although I've kind of up there in years now, I hate to say it, but when I first started in the profession, it was at the advent of when the computer was beginning to take shape. And so I did draw, drafted typically by hand all through, you know, high school and college. But then when I got out of college, I was fortunate to land a job at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and that was at that firm at the time and was at the forefront of using computer technology. And so I was put in a class my first day and learning the programs that the firm was using. So I was fortunate to be at the forefront of using those tools and understand the power of them and understand how important it is to have the best and greatest tools. And now what we can do with particularly communicating our design ideas to our clients with the use of, you know, three-dimensional imaging and now virtual reality is quite amazing. But also the construction process has become much more efficient because of the tools and the programs we're using and how we're able to turn over those digital models to the contractor so that our designs can be realized more efficiently and hopefully in a better way.
So when a project like this begins, how much creativity do you and your team get to have, are ideas dictated to you and then you come up with stuff, or do you let your imagination go and just start designing something fresh?
Well, I think it's all of the above. Any good design is a process of collaboration, and the collaboration comes in many different forms. First and foremost, it has to come from the client. The client sometimes does come with ideas, and that's great. And that feedback from the client, initial goal setting and ideas of what they want, and also the process of them commenting on what we're doing is very important. But clearly, they come to us for our ideas, and for our process, and we try to create as open an environment as possible so those ideas come from a variety of places. And that collaboration and that thought process is what, you know, really makes buildings, can really make buildings great. And it also, you know, you also can't discount what comes from other disciplines in our field, like the engineering disciplines and other disciplines that contribute to the built environment. You know, those are also, those folks are also very creative and can really, if you engage them properly, can really have a huge impact on the outcome.
Earlier, I mentioned that your staff, from the picture on the website, you have a diverse staff. You have a young looking staff. Is this an old man's game or a young man, woman, and men's game?
Well, architecture typically has been known as an old man's game, no question. And it does take a long time to learn our profession and establish the credibility with folks that are going to entrust you. Spending a lot of their money, frankly. These buildings are complicated and take years to build and have big financial impacts. So architecture historically has been an old man's game, and unfortunately it's been primarily a man's game as well. It's well documented that women in our profession have not grown as equitably as men. So that's something I truly believe in, is gender diversity. And if you look at our website, you'll see we have women in positions of leadership at every level, and we're actually, I think, over 50% women right now in our firm. We, you know, the cultural diversity subject is also extremely important, and you know, it's particularly timely with the discussions that are going on in our country. Many of my staff are from different countries, or their parents are from different countries. And having that diversity of thought is extremely important. You know, if you have a group of, you know, as you say, old men, you know, the old men's game, if it's a bunch of old white guys sitting around a table, you're likely not going to get as diverse and vibrant thought processes you would from people of different ethnicities and different places, different genders, and it breeds better and bigger ideas.
We had the CEO of one of the city's big construction companies in for this very segment previously, and we got into a discussion about how they're already planning and working on projects in the future taking climate change into account. This is building roads and bridges. How much of that goes into building buildings?
It's at the forefront, and all of us are very attuned to it. It's good practice. You know, as buildings are, you know, when people think of what's affecting our climate, they often think of automobiles or other types of things, but it's actually buildings that emit the bulk of the carbon to our atmosphere. We can have a direct impact that construction gentleman, as well as because the construction process is equally as important. The waste and how you handle things on site is just as important as the building planning. But how we plan buildings to be as energy efficient as possible is just good sound planning. You know, from the client's perspective, but also, you know, socially conscious and important, you know, for our environment. And our staff, you mentioned the age of our staff. We do have, you know, we have a diversity of age groups as well. We do have a high contingent of young people who that is extremely important to them. I mean, they're here longer than, I guess, us, and we're all, you know, looking out to our children and our grandchildren. And so having you know, that at the forefront of what we do is extremely important.
It must be extra rewarding too for you and your designers to go to these buildings when they're done. Do you go after you finish a project just to go to a building and see it after it's finished?
Yeah, I go all the time. I mean, I to me that is what makes it all worthwhile. You know, if I'm having a bad afternoon, I might just you know, skip a meeting. Although I guess I shouldn't be broadcasting that. And then I will go over to a construction site, because to me, that is the most exhilarating thing, is to be able to walk around and through buildings that we're working on, and not only when they're completely finished, but in the process as well. You know, we purposefully, our name, the first letter of our firm is a small B, and it stands for build, because, you know, it's quite easy to draw things It's not as easy to get things built. There's a lot of factors that have to come into play, many of which are under our control and many of which are not under our control. But getting a project built is what it's all about. So to me, that is, you know, I get the most joy out of going to see things, you know, while they're being built and after they're finished.
You mentioned earlier you worked with the Skidmore, one of the historic firms. What have you brought from your past that's helped you at this moment now to be in charge of your own firm?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, I had a great long career there. I was a partner in a Chicago office, and before I broke off and started my own company. And for me, you know, having that autonomy in creating things, and not only creating buildings, but also creating a practice and a culture and a set of ideals around a business, were really kind of drove me to really start my own thing. And you know, I was fortunate to work all over the world on some of the most complicated projects built, and so I've seen and done a lot of different things. So, you know, again, it's an architecture is it's a team sport. So, you know, I'm not proclaiming to know and be able to do everything, but knowing enough to who to call and who to pull in, and fortunately, who I've been able to pull into my firms, a lot of which are my former colleagues who came with me, is just as important as anything to get a building done. So, and you know, I was also involved in had some responsibilities in running the business as well. So I was able to learn a lot about that end of the profession. So all those things have kind of contributed to my experience in hoping to lead a productive and good firm that will last, you know, be sustainable and last for a long time.
We've been talking about a lot about building the new buildings, new stuff that's underway. Talk to me a little bit about old stuff that's out there. How big of a role do you have in historical preservation of architecture, and is that a big deal at your firm?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, again, that's a passion of a lot of the folks that I have that work with me. And one of the most exciting projects we're doing is it's called House of Tomorrow, and there were, I believe, 5 or 6 houses that were built as part of the Century of Progress World's Fair in 1930s that was held at Northerly Island. And there were 5 homes of the future. One of them was designed by a very famous firm, Chicago firm Keck & Keck, who's done a lot of beautiful modern homes, particularly on the North Shore. They built this glass, futuristic home that was probably the most interesting of the homes that were built there. Those homes after the fair were all moved to Indiana along the lakeshore at the dunes, and all of them have been restored with the exception of the Keck and Keck house, the House of Tomorrow house. So we have a team working with the Indiana Landmark Society and also the federal landmark, the national landmarks, to restore that house to its former glory and also even bring it forward. So it's really a house of tomorrow from today's standpoint.
Whenever I drive into the city, and I know that people have told me this too, it doesn't even have to be the city, but for me it is. I get like this feeling when I see the city skyline and see the buildings. What is that feeling? Is it an architecture feeling, or is it just, what is that?
I get the same feeling, and I think it's just cities are exciting.
Yeah,
cities are vibrant, right? Great things. I mean, great things happen in cities. You know, obviously we all work in the core. Not everybody does, but we're fortunate to work in the core as you all are. But there's also now people are living in the core. You know, of course, we're going to museums. The schools are you know, being continually improved. I think anybody has that feeling of just excitement when you're coming into a city. And I think the other thing about Chicago is the density is such that it just makes it more exhilarating, because you see, and we keep getting more, as you mentioned, that we keep getting more dense because we have more and more cranes. But I think it's a feeling that everybody has at some point.
And I'm sure there are people at your firm dreaming, too, of the time when we are coming in and maybe we'll be in a plane or a drone or something and there'll be Jetsons-type stuff spinning around. That's where we're headed, isn't it? No, or no?
No, I think we are. I mean, I think, you know, it's just amazing, these driverless cars and these things that are going on. So I think it all bodes well for the future of cities, because if we can get around easier and more efficiently without the use of personal automobiles, you know, cities are going to become even more vibrant and more attractive.
Tom, wonderful meeting you. All the best to everybody at your firm, and please come back.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
Tom Kerwin is the CEO and principal at BKL Architecture in Chicago. You can follow them on Twitter at BKL Architecture and online at BKLArchitecture.com. We're also going to continue our conversation with Tom after the bell this morning and post more of our conversation with the podcast of the opening bell a little bit later on this morning at WGNRadio.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Davis with today's NO Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoNO.com. In Chicago, tech salaries averaged $113,000, which was the third lowest out of 10 U.S. cities, according to a new report from Hired, a job marketplace. However, tech salaries in the Windy City are up from $106,000 in 2016 and $107,000 in 2015. But nationwide, San Francisco tech workers are paid the most, making an average of $142,000 a year. A federal judge ruled that Grubhub delivery drivers are independent contractors and not employees of the Chicago-based food delivery company. The judge ruled that a gig economy driver doesn't receive the same protections that employees do under California law. According to official court documents, the ruling could influence the way other gig economy companies like Uber operate. And Fortune put together a list of the 50 best workplaces for giving back, and three Chicago companies made the list, including AbbVie, Crow Horath, and West Monroe Partners. That's today's NO Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoNO.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again. Welcome back to the program. 5:41 now here on our Monday edition of the program. There's a new report out on the number of smartphone users and the number of apps that financial apps that they have on their smartphones. Why are we studying this? Robert Barba is with us today, senior analyst at Bankrate.com. Robert, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Thanks for having me.
So that's the first question. Why are we studying this particular number of people who have these apps and the number of apps?
Well, we wanted to look into, you know, smartphones were released about 11 years ago, and mobile banking is about, you know, so 11 years in, and we wanted to see kind of how much people have taken to it in the decade since its release. And our study found that 63% of adults who have a smartphone, 63% of them have at least one app. The average was 2.5 apps, financial apps, on their phone.
And so what are we thinking, what are we talking about here in terms of financial apps? Are these banking apps, or are they just all of the above?
Well, so it's banking apps, it's investing apps, budgeting apps, and payments. Those are the four that we looked at. And the banking apps were the ones that had the highest traction. More people use, more people have them, more people, they use them more frequently. Of course, there's some millennials tend to more use the other ones more than others, the investing apps and the budgeting and payment apps. But we did see, you know, adoption across the board.
63% is a high number, and you said it's across the board, including people, baby boomers and Gen Xers like myself, who I guess what have been a little hesitant to get into this space.
Yeah, you know, there are people who don't want to get into mobile banking that usually fall into two categories. One, they're very content with their way of banking, right? They're the folks who you see in line at the branch. They're the ones on the phone as they're waiting in line, but they're content with it. And for them, banks have to kind of, in order for them to adopt it, they have to come up with a reason that mobile banking offers something that they can't find anywhere else, right? And maybe those are some of the features that go beyond just customer service, such as the card-free ATM. We're seeing that pop up more and more, the ability to not have to put your card in and worry about it being skimmed at the ATM. That's a mobile carrot, if you will. The other thing is again, security. People think it's not trustworthy, but in reality, mobile provides some capabilities that are they're stronger than what online banking would be. For instance, online banking, you log in with the username and password. Mobile has some better things to use. Biometrics, your face, your thumb, those are stronger things. Also, we found that people who use mobile banking tend to be more engaged in their money. They're checking it multiple times a week, so you're more likely to spot fraud. So in a lot of ways, mobile banking is more secure than other online channels.
Yeah, and that latter part of it is important because the study shows that a lot of people are using these standalone apps to budget, and you mentioned the investing, but the budget is the big one. Lots of, especially millennials, budgeting out every dime they have, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, it stems from a few things. I think one, they're the children of the Great Recession, and so they are very conscious of their money. A lot of the young ones are not making a whole lot, and so they are trying to look for help in order to get it. And, you know, I think that there's, when I sometimes hear these stats specifically about the younger millennials of what they want, sometimes they want spending limits. They want their bank to hold, to keep them from themselves. There's a way to kind of react to that and think, oh, well, you know, okay, the kids of helicopter parents want a helicopter bank. But really, it's a smart move because they're realizing their own limitations and asking someone for help.
You mentioned the carrot earlier. I know that in my family, the carrot was not having to go to the bank and deposit a check anymore, taking a photograph of it or a scan. And then the other one, too, was this notion that you can send money to people if you need to, you know, borrow money or lend money. Those are the two. How are those carrots working for especially the people who've been a little hesitant? And what other carrots might be coming, do you think?
Well, listen, that remote deposit capture is by far the largest, the favorite feature of mobile banking. People really, really love that. And, you know, payments with the largest banks getting together to offer Zelle, which allows for fast person-to-person payments. People really want that capability, the ability to quickly move money, you know, split checks, pay rent. They want that capability to be very easy.
The Zelle part of this, I didn't realize until just researching for this segment that Zelle is being used by multiple banks, right? And so you can transfer money even if you're not a customer of that bank.
I don't want to get into specifics because I can't remember exactly how it all works, but it is the largest banks got together to figure out, let's come up with a way that we can move money quickly between each other and allow our customers to very quickly send money to each other.
Robert,
you asked about the other features,
sure.
The other things that we might see coming down the line. I mean, if you look kind of out in the future, you're going to see a lot more voice banking. Some of the skills that we see with like Alexa or Siri and how that kind of fits into it. You know, look, the banks, as they come up with it, they're looking at what they call contextual banking and how can we help our customers where they are. And you think that might be like comparison shopping tools. It could be when you walk into a bank branch, because the only reason you need to go to a bank branch in the future is for a problem that your phone communicates to the teller that you've arrived and here's what you're looking for.
That's pretty cool. The other part of what you said there about you know, this just being the contextual part of this, the voice part of this, to think that you'll be able to sit on your couch and tell your device, hey, what's my balance or pay this bill? That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think that's the future. Look, chatbots are expected to be a major part of banking going forward. And, you know, you go to some of these banking conferences and these kind of futurist technologists talk about the post-app world, right? When we move out of just going to the app of your bank and kind of it's integrated with, you know, Facebook Messenger or Alexa or Siri, and you're just able to bank that way.
Robert, for people who've not yet jumped into this field yet, has the survey picked out some of the more popular names of these apps? Like, for instance, the banking apps and the pay-to-pay, the peer-to-peer, or whatever it's called. What are the popular versions that you heard from this study, this survey?
Well, so the most popular of the apps were banking apps, right? People are most likely to download their banking app. Here's an interesting thing from another survey, and that's like the J.D. Power customer satisfaction survey. The big banks have had a really, really hard time in J.D. Power for a long time. But given the fact that, you know, they have like JP Morgan, I think a couple years ago, their tech budget was $9 billion, and I'm sure it has certainly not gone down. They have the ability to build these really robust, popular, well-designed, beautiful apps, and customers are now assigning customer satisfaction to that. Like they think of how well the app is as a part of their satisfaction as a customer. And so the banking apps are the ones that are the most popular. But look, some of the community banks do a pretty good job too. You know, I talked about card-free ATMs. Your local bank there, Wintrust. Wintrust had that a couple of years before all the largest banks did, and I think BMO Harris also did too.
Some of the names people might recognize here: Venmo, PayPal, Square Cash. These are the peer-to-peer and the investments and budgeting apps: Mint, Clarity, Money, and Wally. Some of those names that are out there: Stash, Acorns, Betterment. For investing. This is very cool. Robert, thanks for the data on this. Always good conversation.
Thank you so much.
All right, Robert Barba, senior analyst at Bankrate.com. 63% of smartphone users have one or more financial apps on their phones.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures up 256 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures up about 1% as well, heading to the opening bell later this morning. Now the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue continuing his travels across the United States this week. Today, he will be appearing at the Las Vegas livestock operation, accompanied by Nevada Director of Agriculture Jim Barbie and Mr. Hank Combs, Las Vegas livestock partner. And then this is the week of the big outdoor farm shows for the winter season. We have them during the summer with Farm Progress and all of the other events. But starting on Tuesday, tomorrow, Tulare, California, for the World Ag Expo, a three-day event at the permanent site just off the main highway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. On the same day, Louisville, Kentucky, the opening of the National Farm Machinery Show and Championship Tractor Pulling Competition. That will go through Saturday. World Expo at Tulare will go through Thursday. And then in Sacramento, California, on Thursday through Saturday of this week, the National Outstanding Young Farmer Program, where 10 finalists in national competition, four of the couples will be named National Outstanding Young Farmers for 2018. So a lot of activity off the farm, but certainly involved in agriculture this coming week. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Monday, February 12th. The Senate holds a procedural vote on immigration legislation today. President Trump's FY19 budget proposal is released. Also today, wreath laying observances at the Lincoln Memorial to mark Abraham Lincoln's birthday. It's going to be a busy week, too. Lots going on. Tomorrow, we'll see the National Small Business Optimism Index released. On Wednesday, consumer prices, retail sales, and business inventories. On Thursday, jobless claims. And on Friday, housing starts, consumer sentiment, and import and export prices. So a busy week with economic reports trying to move the markets one way or the other as we head into the week.